Thank you for coming back. So we have our last talk today by Professor Michel Baudouin-Lafont, who is at the University of Paris-Saclay and also this year's winner of the Médaille d'Argent in computer science for in France here. And Michel and I have worked together for over, well, about 30 years now, so I know him very well. I'm married to him, actually, so I know him really well. And but I invited him here because he has this extraordinary background in human-computer interaction and basically one of the founders of the field, and certainly here in France. And what he's going to do is talk at a higher level and talk more about how we think about human-computer interaction and then how to get to human-computer partnerships from an HCI perspective. So, Michel.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about these topics. So the title is Information Theory Meets Human-Computer Partnerships. That's a big title. I don't know if I will deliver on it, but you'll tell me at the end. First of all, I would like to, since there's a word theory in the title, I would like to talk a little bit about the role of theory in human-computer interaction. This is actually the slides that Wendy had yesterday in her talk, but there was a glitch and she couldn't really present them. As she was explaining, based on the work she did with Anne-Laure Fayard in the last century, in the sciences, in the natural sciences, research goes back and forth between theory and observation. And so in some fields, you may start from a theory. I think the example you take is psychology or physics. And then you build experiments to support or refute your theory. And then you revise or extend your theory. And then you do new observations, etc. In other fields, anthropology, for example, you start from observations of the real world. And then from that, you build, they tend to call them frameworks rather than theories, then prompt for new observations to, again, refine and extend it. So this is all nice and good. Now, in HCI, we are in what Herb Simon calls a science of the artificial, in that we are creating artifacts, and we actually change the nature of the things that we are studying, which is not supposed to be the case in natural sciences, where you're supposed to be an external, unbiased observer. Here, we create the artifact that did when study. And the research process then goes back and forth between theory and artifact creation, observation and artifact creation, and then evaluation of the artifact, and then using more theory or refining a theory for this particular problem, and et cetera. Now, in the history of human-computer interaction, a lot of design methods have been developed, and I would place them in here between observation and artifacts. So when we do interviews, when we do participatory design, when we do surveys, questionnaires, evaluations through qualitative or quantitative means, it all sits in between there. And theory is sort of floating above there, like we talk about the theory of affordances. But it's not really operationalized in our design, in our research process, in the same way as these design methods have been over the years. And so together with Susanna Bodker from University of Aarhus in Denmark and Wendy here, published a paper last year, which was a result of a long history of research together and reflecting on the role of theory. And we introduced the notion of generative theory of HCI. And the goal of these generative theories is to bridge the gap, in a sense, between the body of existing theories from the natural science, from psychology, from sociology and ethnography, etc., and this process of building artifacts. Now, this is not a one or the other. You still have to use the design methods like participatory design, but we're adding a means to integrate theory in a more operationalized way in the design process. And so, what is a generative theory? So, a generative theory first has to be grounded in existing theories of human behavior. And that can be a range of things. I mentioned theory of affordances from Gibson. I'll come back to Gibson in a minute. I'll also talk about Paul Fitts and Fitts' law, which was there before HCI existed. There are things like distributed cognition that we also talk about in HCI a lot. Boundary objects, all these existing theories of human behavior, either individual or social, or in recent years there's also cultural studies that have come into play and all that. But these theories tend to be abstract in the sense that they don't apply immediately to HCI. So a generative theory of interaction identifies a set of concepts and operationalizes them in a set of generative principles so that these theories become usable, I would say, in our HCI design process. So in the talk I give in lesson two of Wendy's chair here, I talked about reification. The idea that an abstract concept can be turned into a concrete object that user can manipulate. So reification gets inspired from a theory called technical reasoning, also from the theory of affordances, but reification is something that we can apply. And for the past 20 years, we've been teaching that to our students, to our group, and we've been using it very productively, and I showed a few examples in that talk. Now, the way to use the theories is through three lenses. The first one is what we call the analytical lens. Those concepts can be used to analyze, to deconstruct the existing artifacts. So to observe and interpret existing artifacts through those principles. The critical lens sort of extends this analytical lens by being critical of these existing artifacts, but again, through those principles. So I can say, well, in this system, they did not use reification, but if they did, this is what it could have given them. And that sort of opens the way to revising existing artifacts or creating new ones. And then the last one is the constructive lens, which is really what gives the name generative theory of interaction, where we use those principles, I don't want to say out of the blue, but not necessarily based on existing artifacts, but to create new solutions. And in the lecture I gave, I talk about how with reification we created this alignment guidelines that help people align objects on the screen a lot more efficiently. And so the goal of all this is that you can create new artifacts and then sort of participate in this process that I was illustrating before. So what we find is this concept of generative theory is quite powerful because oftentimes we really are at, it's difficult to find how to apply a particular theory. And what we call for in the paper I was citing is for the community to create more of these generative theories. In the paper, we give three examples from our respective work. Wendy has talked about co-adaptation as another one of these generative theory with principles like discoverability, expressivity, and appropriability. But we should have more of these theories. More theory is good. The history of theories is that some survive, some disappear, some merge, some get developed, etc. And so we need the same thing in HCI. Okay, so now what I'm going to talk about in this talk is a body of theory around the notion of information. I borrowed also this drawing from Wendy's slides, which is interaction between a human and a computer. And we want to treat interaction as a phenomenon that we can study and a phenomenon that we can control. Designing new artifacts on the computer side is a way to create a phenomenon of interaction and to control it, in a sense. Now, if we consider these two arrows that represent the phenomenon of interaction, what is that is being sent by the user to the computer? What is being sent by the computer to the user? What are these arrows? Now, in many HCI classes, we say, well, the user provides input to the computer, or the user enters commands. And that can be by typing, by clicking, by speech, by gesturing, all of that. And then the system processes it, and then sends back a response. And the response is typically updating the display, or maybe making a sound, or having a voice synthesis, or something like this. Now, what if instead we think of these exchanges as exchanges of information? That is, taking interaction as the communication of information from the user to the system, from the system back to the user. Now, if we talk about interaction, there are a couple of theories there that have addressed the topic of how humans interact, our systems interact in terms of information. And I'll mention two here. One is James Gibson. Now, James Gibson is a psychologist who is famous for having initiated the movement called ecological psychology and the notion of ecological perception. Now, in HCI, he is known mostly for the notion of affordance, which has been, I must say, butchered by a lot of misunderstanding of what the concept is really about. But I'm not going to talk about affordance today, because, in fact, affordances in his work are a very small part of his work. In his book, The Ecological Approach to Visual Perception, he talks about how organisms, animals, not just humans, have co-evolved with their environment. And that coevolution, of course, links with the notion of co-adaptation that Wendy has been talking about. But here he's really talking about coevolution at the scale of evolution, Darwinian evolution, so millennia. And so his argument is organisms have evolved to perceive what there is to perceive in the world that is meaningful to them and to their survival. And for this, they have developed elegant perceptual processes. Elegant, I quote because that's how he calls it, elegant and parsimonious, meaning energy efficient in a way. And so he studied in particular visual perception and has a whole development around the notion of perceiving the optical array, what he calls the optical array, and the optical flow. And his big argument is that we always tend to think of our visual system as, you know, we have a little camera in the brain behind our eyes that's filming what's going on, and then, you know, something there that he calls the homunculus interpreting that. And he's saying that doesn't work, because how does the homunculus work? And so the way visual perception works is not the way sort of a system that does a visual analysis from arrays of pixels is working. And in particular, he has this notion of information pickup, the idea that we extract information from the world that is what we need for the particular activity at hand. And so in this picture, which is on the cover of the book, you see this bird flying. And these arrows here represent the optical flow, meaning from one image to the next, that would be this, the wrong analogy, but as you move through space, things move around you. And so you can imagine replacing each little pixel in your surrounding by a little arrow of how it has moved from the previous snapshot. And so things that are on your side tend to move faster than things that are right in front of you. And in fact, there is something that he calls an invariant, that is that in any optical flow due to locomotion, the only fixed point in this optical flow is the direction towards which you're going. And he argues that our visual system perceives that directly. Now, whether or not our perceptual system is equipped to extract those invariants and how it works exactly is not our concern here. However, there is ample evidence that the visual system has neurons that are programmed to extract things like vertical lines or corners or things like this. So there's a lot of support for this idea. The other strong concept in this theory is the notion of action-perception coupling. And it was mentioned actually yesterday by one of the speakers. You need to act to perceive. I think it was it Jim? You need to act to perceive, and you need to perceive to act. You need to act to perceive because, for example, if you're touching something, you need to move your hand to have an actual sensation. Your eyes always do micro movements. If they don't, you don't see. It's that simple. Now, you also need to perceive to act because, of course, if I'm trying to grab an object here on the desk, my eye are going to guide my movement. A robot would be perfectly able to take a picture, then close the camera, and then move the arm to the perfect position. But a human wouldn't be able to do that. Even if nothing moves and all that, it's very hard to do this. So we need to act, we need to perceive our surroundings in order to act efficiently. This is a picture I also borrowed from Wendy's talk that when she mentioned Gibson with this idea of invariant. If you throw a ball at a dog or another human being, the sure way to catch the ball, even if there is wind or if the ball does weird things or here the stick, is to maintain a constant angle between the motion of the ball and your own motion. And so this is a type of invariant that we're talking in information theory, in the ecological perception. Okay, now as you can see, this is not a theory that we can apply sort of readily. I think to this day, we haven't really figured out how to operationalize this notion, but I think the notion of invariant is interesting and is captured in, for example, the rules of Gestalt, Gestalt perception. And Gibson talks about the Gestalt, which was the theory that was existing before then, where you know the way objects are laid out is perceived globally instead of individual objects. It's also captured in a lot of principles that are used in animation to convey the notion of a movement that is natural. And for example, if I move my hand from here to here, you feel that I've moved it at constant speed, which of course is impossible because I started without motion and I ended without motion. So I accelerated and then went slower. But for you, I went from A to B in sort of linear movement. And so all these things sort of build on this theory of invariant extraction in a sense. Okay, so that's for James Gibson. Now we turn to the other big guy in information theory, Claude Shannon. So Claude Shannon invented the theory of information around 1948. Seminal paper is from 1948. And he imagined this concept of information when working on how to transmit information over telephone lines or landlines or any kind of medium. And his concept is that the information carried by an event that has a probability P of X is this formula, log of 1 over the probability, which is equivalent to minus the log of the probability. Now, we don't need to understand what that means, really. The point is that the more unlikely an event is, the higher information it carries. So if I throw a coin, it can go on heads or tails, and it's a 50-50% chance. So if you apply the formula, you'll see that a particular draw will carry an information of 1 bit, which means I can encode it in 1 bit. 1 for tails, 0 for heads, for example. For a dice, because there are 6 possibilities, a particular outcome will carry more information because there are more uncertainty about the outcome. Now, based on this concept of information, there is then the concept of entropy, which if you consider random variables, so if you throw the dice a number of times, what is, on average, the information that will be provided by a particular draw, which is also an estimate on the amount, the number of bits you need to encode that information. One, and I don't want to go into the details of any of this, but one thing to keep in mind is that the entropy is going to be maximal when the distribution is uniform. If your dice has 6 sides and they're all equivalent, then you have the entropy of 2.53 that I mentioned. If some sides of the dice are more likely, because it's loaded, then the entropy will be lower because some things are more likely than others, and so overall there is less surprise in the result. And if you think of text in English, there's been a lot of studies on this. If you look at not just the probability of letters, but also the probability of pairs of letters, after a T, you are more likely to have an H or an I than other letters. The entropy of text is very low. Each character can be encoded with about one bit of information, which is why your spelling correctors work pretty well, or spelling predictor work pretty well, is because there is very little uncertainty when you start typing enough text. Now, the really important contribution of Shannon is to have formalized information transmission, where you have a source that emits that wants to emit a message. The encoder encodes this message in the most efficient way using these probability distributions. Then it goes over a channel. The channel is noisy, so some things may be changed, some things may disappear, so the Y that you get at the output is not exactly the X that you got at the input. Then you decode with the inverse of the encoder, so you had letters encoded into bits. On the decoder, you get bits decoded into letters, and the destination can read the message. But some information is going to be lost with this formula. Again, I'm going to details, but it captures the fact that the information that is transmitted can be damaged on the way, and we'll need that in a moment. And then the big contribution of Shannon is his theorem 17 in his paper, which is the capacity of a channel subject to Gaussian noise, which is the typical noise you get when you send bits over a wire. That has this formula: the capacity, which is the maximum transmitted information, is the bandwidth multiplied by this formula. Now, I just want you to take a picture of that formula, not try to understand it. P is the signal that is being sent, N is the noise. Okay, so why am I talking about all this? Let's get back to this diagram where I had the information exchange between the user and the computer. If I'm thinking of what the user is sending to the computer, it's sending messages, commands in some sort, as I said. And that seems to be kind of work well with Shannon's notion of information, that I'm sending information of a channel. There may be errors. I may mistype, I may mispoint, or maybe the mouse is not working well. So I'm emitting information that may not arrive at the destination exactly the same. From the computer back to the user, the system is providing typically a display in traditional GUIs. So I think it's more where the notion of information from Gibson is meaningful there, because the user is going to want to extract information from those displays and to do it as efficiently as possible. Now, I'm going to apply this to a very mundane task. After all what we've seen over these 2 days, I feel like it's kind of a downer. Pointing. Isn't that exciting? Well, pointing is exciting because that's what you do the most when you use a computer. I mean, do you imagine the number of times you point, move your mouse, or tap on your screen every day to do anything with a computer? So if we were able to gain at least, 1%, 5% on each time you tap or click, we would save the humanity, huge amount of time. Anyway, so pointing is difficult because on the computer you have many targets. Some targets are very small. If you think of a text that you can edit, every space between each pair of characters is a potential target. You also have all the buttons, all the menus, all the scroll bars, etc. And of course, what we want is to point quickly and to point precisely. And these are a trade-off. You cannot be very quick and very precise at the same time. So it's a little bit like the curve that we've seen between power and simplicity. We would like to shift the curve, to be able to point a little bit faster and a bit more precise. But this trade-off is going to be there. And something that is often ignored in most pointing studies, and I will ignore it today, is the cost of error. I mean, I'm sure you've all mispointed somewhere and closed the window that you very much regret the second after. So integrating the cost of error is still a challenge today. Now, stupid observation, but why do we need to point? I mean, we have all these fancy computers, you know, all this AI out there. We still spend our lives pointing. Well, the thing is that if the computer knew what I wanted to do and what I wanted to point at, it could do it for me. And so the point is, so to speak, that the computer does not know what I want to do. So this is really tied back to the notion of information, because it means that the computer has uncertainty about what I want to do. And my job is going to be to reduce this uncertainty by providing information to the computer about what I want to do. The other thing is that currently, human capabilities are the biggest limitation to pointing performance. You know, you can buy the best mouse you want. It's your muscles, it's your visual system that will define how good you are at pointing. Now, Paul Fitz has studied pointing as a psychologist, also a pioneer in aviation safety. It was mentioned yesterday. Also the author of this What Humans Are Good At, What Machines Are Good At list that Thomas mentioned yesterday, but is most known in our field, at least, for studying pointing. And is the he gave his name to the law called Fitz Law, which is exploring this speed-precision trade-off in aimed movements. And so this is his apparatus to come up with this law. Two targets, a pen, so the targets are actually strips of metal, the pen is also metallic, and so if you hit the target, it closes the circuit, and so you go back and forth, and you can very precisely time the time it takes to go from one to the other. And there are two parameters to this task. One is what's called an F target amplitude, but that we call distance, D the distance to target, and the other parameter is the size of the target width. This is what we call a 1D pointing, because you only go back and forth, left and right. We don't do all the directions. And he predicted, and his experiment supported, the fact that the movement time, the time it takes to do one pointing gestures, was proportional to what he called the index of difficulty, which is the log of 1 plus D over W. The distance gets longer, takes more time. The size gets smaller, it takes more time. So D over W actually captures this trade-off. Here's the data from his paper, beautifully aligned regression between the index of difficulty and the movement time. And in HCI, Fitz's law is used heavily as a tool to compare pointing devices or pointing techniques. Because whether you're pointing, you're tapping on your screen, you're pointing with a mouse, with a trackpad, with your eyes, with your whatever, this law is very robust. What changes is the K here. So, you know, the K is the slope of the curve that I had here. So if you have a lower value for K, then you can point more efficiently. You're still subjected to the law, but you can point more efficiently. Now, what's interesting is, I'm really going very slow here. Now, if you had taken a picture in your head of the formula of capacity from Shannon, log of 1 plus P over N, and the one I just showed here, MT is proportional to the index of difficulty, you see an analogy. And in fact, this analogy is very compelling, because the distance is a signal. The distance to the target is a signal you want to send to the system. How far is the target that I want to reach? And the width of the target is the tolerance, the you know, how much you can have noise that will actually perturb this distance, how wide you can point around the center of the target. Now, this is an analogy, but you know, the units are different, so, and it's just based analogy because the two formulas look the same, which is kind of a, a little bit weak. Now, we can actually derive the index of difficulty as the entropy of a variable. If you imagine that between your starting point and the stopping point, you have you tiled several targets of size W, and your job is which one are you going to select. Here, I want to select the one at the position stop. But I could select any of the other ones, and so the variable x would be the values of the possible center of the targets, starts at minus d.2 here, d.2 plus w plus 2w, etc. And if I calculate the entropy of this, I get exactly the index of difficulties, isn't that marvelous? Well, it is cute, but there's no transmission here, so it's just it's not really using the notion of information theory as formalizing the transmission of information. Now, Julien Gory and Olivier Rioul and Yves Guillard, a few years ago, took that on. Olivier Rioul is an accomplished information theorist from Telecom Paris Tech. And they came up with this model for how the user is transmitting information to the computer in a pointing task, where the channel has a noise which is caused by what they call neural noise that makes you, you know, not point exactly always where you want because you have various sources of noise in the motor system. And so, in short, they were able to recover the formula of the capacity of that channel, which shows, once again, the index of difficulty, 1 plus d over w, but with this factor 1 minus e, where e is the error rate. And I think this is really an astonishing accomplishment to have linked the notion of information from Shannon with Fitts' law and pointing in a way that is very rigorous. Now, Fitts' law has limits. You cannot point, if I'm sitting here and I want to go and point at the switch at the other end of the room, I'm going to have to run, and this is not going to follow Fitts' law, because Fitts' law works only if you can accelerate as much as you can until you have to slow down. So typically, the maximum distance is the amplitude of the arm. The maximum, the minimum target size is limited by motor tremor. So, you know, half a millimeter, say, and maximum distance about a meter. So the index of difficulty is about 11 bits. And so all Fitts studies, you know, use this kind of range, because beyond that, it's just not valid. There are other laws of movement. We talked about Fitts' law in 1D. When you go to 2D, it's already complicated. There is goal passing, where you cross a goal instead of clicking in it. There is a steering law, where you can try to traverse a tunnel, and all these have expressions with formulas similar to what I've shown. So it's a very interesting field to try to really capture this essential type of interaction with predictive laws. Now, the thing I want to talk about now is how to beat Fitts' law. Now, it's frustrating that we spend so much time clicking and tapping and reaching for targets. Now, what if we think of pointing as a human-computer partnership? How can I have the computer help me point more efficiently? I mean, the computer should be able to do something there. Currently, it does not. In fact, pointing on a computer with a mouse is a little bit less efficient than pointing in the physical world because of the device and et cetera. So I'm going to have to speed up here. First, extract user intention. Jerry Cazier gave a very nice presentation in Wendy's lecture number 4 about the use of pointer acceleration or transfer function. The fact that if I move my mouse a little bit, the cursor moves a little bit. But if I make the same movement twice as fast, then the cursor is going to go further away, right? And that's capturing the intention that if I'm moving fast, I'm in the first phase of my pointing movement, it means I want to go far away. So let me get you go there even faster. But as soon as you slow down, the transfer function is lower, meaning you still keep precision. Now, that works. Jerry Cazier did a lot of studies around this. there is a real effect on performance, it's quite moderate. You cannot have that much of a gain. Even if you think, you know, you have your mouse set to the maximum acceleration and you're the king of the pointing, in practice, except for extreme gamers, it doesn't make that big a difference. But it's still convenient because it lets you use a mouse on a small surface or a small trackpad. Another idea was to say, well, why don't let the system take advantage that I'm communicating information as I move to take over from me? Now, you all know inertial scrolling on your smartphone, where you start scrolling and the system keeps scrolling for you. Now, we did the same thing with the cursor, where control the cursor with a trackpad, and if you lift your finger, depending on the speed at liftoff, the cursor will continue by itself. And then if it doesn't go where you want, you can stop it, you can redirect it, sort of like when you're pushing a hoop if you're a kid. So it did improve, so interestingly, it does not improve pointing time. So not very interesting, maybe, but it gives a very different feeling to really sort of pushing the cursor rather than being in control all the time. And so it means that I'm transmitting the same amount of information in less time, because the time over which I control the cursor is shorter than if I control it all over. And so I think there's something to explore here, if we could couple that with other methods I'm going to talk about. Now, second approach, the one that's been the most explored, is to use information about the targets. Because one thing that the computer has that the real world does not have is the computer knows where the targets are. And so if we know this landscape of targets, we can help the user, and especially if we also know the distribution of probability that the user has to hit a particular target. So in semantic pointing here, what we did with Renaud Blanc and Yves Guillard was to decouple the way things look for you, the user, from the way things look for the computer, for the mouse. So here you see a dialog box with three buttons. One is dangerous, don't save. One is probably the default and the most likely, save. Now, from your mouse, what you see, what the mouse sees, or the landscape, is the one at the bottom, meaning big save button, easier to reach than the don't save, which is much smaller and harder to reach. Now, this little video illustrates what happens. So here, that's what I see on the left. The right is the what the mouse sees. Right now, we are in normal pointing, so it's exactly the same on the left and on the right. Now, I activate semantic pointing, and you'll see on the right, as I approach this tiny resize button, it gets bigger. When I approach the title, it gets a little bit bigger, not as much. When I approach an icon, it gets bigger as well. And so the idea is that, in a sense, you compress the empty space between targets because there's nothing interesting there. But when you approach a target, you can decide how important it is and how much you want to enlarge it. And what we showed is that the pointing time is predicted by the enlarged target size, not by the visual target size, which is really a real gain. Now, you can push this to the limit by having Yves Guillard called object pointing, where your cursor is not even going to go into the empty space. It's going to jump to the next target. As soon as you exit the target, it's going to find the next one in that direction and land there. Now, this is the one and only example I know where we actually beat Fitts' law, because we have constant pointing time. Constant pointing time. That's super cool, right? Well, except that when you have multiple targets, if you don't land on the right one, then you're going to really spend a lot of time getting back to where you wanted, and et cetera. So error correction is so costly that, in fact, the advantage of this constant pointing time in standard sort of a setup is not useful. Now, this idea of sort of ignoring empty space gave rise to the bubble pointer by Grossman and Balakrishnan. So here you say, well, even if you're not pointing on the target, since the only thing you want to point at are targets, I will make you point on the closest target. So we build what's called the Voronoi diagram of the targets, tiling of the space, where each area represents all the points that are closer to the target in it than to any other target. And so the video should play here. No, it didn't. Hello. Yes. And so you see the bubble, the cursor gets bigger to, that was too fast. The cursor gets big enough to enclose the closest target. And so you can minimize travel time because the targets are effectively the size of these tiles here. This was improved by Olivier Chapuis and colleagues with DynaSpot, where they combine, in fact, a bubble-like cursor that expands, not as much as we saw before because it's a bit distracting, but also if you slow down, it turns into a regular cursor, so you can actually point individual pixels on the screen. Another possibility is this idea that we can expand targets as you get close to them. Again, extracting the intention. If I'm next to a target and I'm slowing down, probably I want to point at the target nearby, so why not make it bigger then? So here we are modifying both the visual space and the motor space. Both MacGuffin and MacGuffin and ourselves with Shumin Zhai showed that it works. But in fact, it's not really valuable because in real settings, targets tend to be packed together. And if some of you know the dock from Mac OS, which is the row of icons at the bottom, you can put it in a mode where when you approach it, the icon next to the cursor gets bigger. So it expands. But the problem is that because all the targets are tiled together, they need to push the targets around it, which means that as I move my cursor horizontally, even though the target gets bigger, it sort of slips under my cursor. And in fact, its effective size is not any bigger. So expanding targets, good idea, but not much practical application. Drag and pop. So here the idea is for dragging instead of pointing, that when I drag towards a direction, the system will bring to me the icons where I would want to drop my dragged icon. So a very clever idea from Patrick Bodish here. Works only for drag, so it's not a general solution for pointing. Okay, so then we wanted to break another aspect of FITSLO, which is the limitation in precision and distance. And for this, we move to zoomable user interfaces. Now, these days, we all know zoomable user interfaces with Google Maps, where you know you zoom in, you zoom out, you pan, etc. In a zoomable interface, you can potentially zoom indefinitely. Here, it's a drawing interface. I can keep drawing and then zooming in, zooming out. What we showed with Yves Guillard is that when you do this movement to go from A to B in a map, where you have to zoom out first, then get to have your target in view, and then zoom in and pan to adjust to get to the final target. Very different type of motion than pointing from A to B. If you do that, so I don't have time to explain those diagrams, but we did this with indices of difficulty over 30. Remember, regular pointing gets to ID about 10. 10 means 2 to the power of 10, a ratio of about 1,000 between the distance and the size of the target. ID 30 means 2 to the power 30, that's several billion, between the size of the target and their distance. It's like if I'm here and I want to point, the analogy that Yves takes is, I want to go pick a flower in a garden in New Zealand from here, from Paris. That's the precision of the task. And I can do it with a prediction that is perfectly in line with Fitts' law. We played with the size of the target as the size of the view, because we figured if the view gets smaller and smaller, like on the watch, it's going to be easier to lose the target, and then it's going to affect performance, which we demonstrated with this formula that movement time is proportional still to ID, but divided by view size if the view is small enough. I'm going to skip Morto Zoom. Sorry for Caroline. And I want to get to the last bit here, which is how to challenge the user. Now, usually we want the computer to help us. But it turns out that there is a way to think of extracting more information from the user by challenging it. You know the game 20 questions, right? You have 20 questions to find the name of the person I have in my head. usually the first question that's being asked is it a man or a woman? Because that sort of divides the choices by half. And so the idea here is we are going to challenge the user so that the user gives us more information in their next input. So the user has a target in mind, and the system has some prior knowledge, a probability distribution of target probability. From that, it can compute an uncertainty with the formula I showed earlier. And the goal of the game is to reduce this uncertainty to zero. For this, the computer provides a display, which here we see sort of as an input to the user. We're shifting the thing on its head, in a sense. I show the user something. The user responds with what we call an input in HCI, but it's response to the system prompt, in a sense. And this input carries some information, and so this information will reduce the uncertainty of the computer and hopefully will go down to zero when the target is reached. Now, the key idea here is there's not much we can do on the input side. The user decides what he wants to do, but we can play with the feedback. We can choose the feedback so that the expected amount of information the system will gain from the next input is maximized. And so the uncertainty will go down faster. Now, formulas, it works. There's math behind it. It's based on information theory, measure of entropy, Bayes rules to update the computer knowledge about what the user goal is, and the measure of the information gain, how much information I have extracted from the user at each step, and how much information I can expect to extract from the next step. Now, the example I have here is navigating a multi-scale map. Suppose I'm looking at the map around Denver, so what I see on my screen is what's in the black square, and I want to navigate to go to New York. Now, the system doesn't know I want to go to New York. So the only actions I can do here is say, go in one of the 8 cardinal directions. I don't say how far, or zoom in the center area. So what I'm going to do is, I'm in Denver, I want to go to New York, I want to go to the east. Now, it turns out that users are not reliable. And we did some studies, and people make mistakes, or maybe they don't know their geography. And in 95% of the time in a situation, they will go right. In 5%, they will go left. And the system can embody this knowledge about user behavior. We update the knowledge and calculate the view that maximizes the expected information gain, which in practice means I'm here on the left. The system is going to look at all the views it could show me and calculate the expected information gain for any possible target based on any of these views, which is a huge calculation, which is the drawback of the method. And based on that, it's going to decide which one is best for it, the system, not for me, the user, for it, the system. And it's going to be this one. Why is this one? Because if I'm here, if I want to go to New York, I will say go east. If I want to go to Kansas City, I will say go west. If I want to go to Chicago or Washington, I will zoom in. So my next input is going to give it more information than if the view had all these 4 cities in it or only one of them. So it's making this compromise in a sense, but it's also challenging me because I'm going to have to really decide the next turn, well, where is it now? And so we calculate then the gain, and then we can loop. I moved here, and then I will still go to the left, to the right. As I go to the right, the probability of things on the left is going down and down, and that sort of improves the system. So the way this this looks is a bit disturbing because you make a move, the system goes somewhere, then you have to realize, well, where am I? Oh, it's not where I wanted, so I go back and then I go in. But in 3 moves, I can be over Paris. If I wanted to go to Helsinki instead, so it starts sort of the same. Now I'm going that direction, I went a bit too far, and then I go there and I'm in Helsinki. Now, so what we found is performance is increased by about 40% compared to standard navigation, and the further away you navigate, the bigger the gain. But what we see, if you look at how we approach the target over time, in blue is with standard navigation, so you see I make steps, and here we didn't have the animation in the video, it was sort of jumps from one view to the next. But when we use big nav, we have this big reduction in ID level, meaning I'm going really fast towards the target, but then there's this long pause because I have to figure out, the user has to figure out, where am I now, what am I doing next? So now there's probably ways to improve that information through maybe invariants and better visual feedback. But the fact that we can gain 40% on the navigation task and the pointing task, essentially, is quite quite spectacular. We did the same thing for file retrieval, and it worked the same. Here we have the traditional list of files at the bottom, and at the top we provide a set of candidates, but they are designed by the big algorithm, so it's not the most likely. It's the one where if you click on one of them, it will tell me, the system, more information about where you want to go. And not going into details, the gains were also 40% compared to the best known technique, which is called AR file here, that's using also some sort of a predictive information, and 64% faster than your regular going through folders in your Finder. Conclusion. Information is a very fruitful concept for interaction. It's kind of disappointing, though, that none of these techniques I've showed are in any commercial product nowadays, even though they improve interaction and efficiency of pointing. The use of information as a concept can be used and has been used for things like text entry, especially because of this low entropy of text, for command selection and for other applications. So to wrap this up, I think theory-driven HCI leads to generative theories that create novel and powerful techniques. Information theory is one of these source theories that is of interest as a source of inspiration and also a tool to create future human-computer partnerships. Thank you.